currencies. Many of them have different languages. And as people travel from country to country 30 years ago, you had to get different money every 50, 100, 200, 400 miles of travel. And so part of what the European Union has been doing is the European Union gets them a common currency and breaks down barriers and tariffs, or as the president likes to say, terriers and bearers, and makes life simpler. The problem is that when you put the vote to the people, there it's very easy to run a campaign that says, no, no, you don't want to be going under the more authority. And in some cases, the European Union wants to overstep their authority in terms of what they regulate. But most of the countries weren't going to put this to a vote. Only Ireland was putting it to a vote because of a quirk in their constitution that requires a plebiscite, I guess I'll call it, but requires a vote of the people on a treaty like this. Most of the other European countries were going to have it approved by their parliaments, and it would have passed most of them. Now, with Ireland rejecting it, there's only two ways to go. Either there'll be a wave of rejections in Europe and this deal will be dead, these new rules will be dead, or Ireland will be essentially removed from the EU. So it's an interesting situation. I guess I'll say one more thing about it. And this is kind of a difference between conservatives and liberals in this country. And it's a difference in intellectual growth. And there's this whole take in this country that conservatives, a blue state of mind, I'm sorry, liberals, a blue state of mind means you want to give away the store. When John Kerry said he would consult our allies, Bush and Cheney made fun with him and said, they want to give France a veto power over our homeland security. Well, of course that's nonsense. But it's easier to make that case than it is to make the more nuanced case that as a country matures and as the world becomes more intertwined, interdependence is the way of the world. And we talk a lot about independence, and people seem to think that the only thing there is besides dependence, which we know is bad, to be dependent on someone else, the only other thing there is independence. No, there is interdependence. And basically what the EU is embarked on is a very mature, higher level of development kind of thinking, which says we are interdependent and let's recognize that reality. Well, there's another reality I want to recognize here, and that reality is the reality of taking a little bit of a station break.
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let me continue with a little bit of this thinking about globalization. It's interesting how it's painted in this country, but the good news for those of us that would like to see us recognize the concept of interdependence and the importance of interdependence, the good news is that we know that the world's moving in this direction. That is, that the normal course of development of individuals and of societies is in this direction. People don't regress backwards. For example, in the area of moral development, most people are familiar with the work of Piaget or Kohlberger. They've heard of it, this idea of how children develop. But Carol Gillian has a model in which she talks about moral development in women. And she's just got three simple stages. And in her research, women go through three stages. The first is care for self, that is a selfish kind of a view of the world. Care for others, meaning others near us, that is, you know, you learn to take care of family, friends, children. And then finally, care for everyone, that is a concern about everyone in the world. And we're not quite there yet. For example, if you look at the casualty figures from Iraq, we care a great deal about Americans' casualties. we don't care as much about Iraqi casualties. That is, we focus on American casualties, and that number is the one that alarms us if a lot of them are being killed, to the point where John McCain will actually make the statement that he doesn't care if we're there for 100 years as long as Americans aren't dying. Now, he doesn't say as long as Iraqis aren't dying, right? It's very important that we look out for American lives. That's not the highest level of intellectual development. That is, at best, second level, where you have concern for your fellow man around you and woman, but not for everyone. So as we develop, the world, the societies are inevitably moving to these higher levels of development. Now, it's a very slow process. It won't happen in my lifetime or maybe even yours, but we are moving in that direction. And that's good news in general. So I'm happy about that. I mean, I look at conservatism and liberalism as in the same way. If you look at the current debate over gays, whether it's gays in the military or gay marriage, this latest thing in California, Republicans and conservatives are fighting a losing battle there. That is, that if you look at the demographics, and they do surveys about how do you feel about any issue related to gays, and what happens is older people have a problem with homosexuality, and it's an important issue for them, and they think it somehow besmirches the state of marriage, or it's just disgusting to think about, or whatever it is. The same is not true when younger people are surveyed. People in their teens, 20s, 30s, they don't care about gays. That's not an issue that is ever going to get them riled up. They aren't going to go out and vote on it. They don't see it as this terrible moral issue. They don't see it as threatening marriage. They know gay people. And those people just go on and lead their lives and leave the heterosexuals alone. So as we go through the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years and the electorate ages and people my age and older die off, a lot of these older attitudes go away and they're replaced with people who are more tolerant, more understanding, because they grew up in these situations. We're leaving aside for the moment the biblical admonition that this is an abomination and that marriage between a man and a woman is what is intended, and anything else would corrupt that institution. I think we've corrupted it ourselves pretty good. But that's the bottom line. So whether it's gays, whether it is, well, I don't want to say war. What was the other issues? Well, the first one was the notion of interdependence. But whether it's gays, global warming, whatever it is, young people are more open to new ideas. And so to the extent that new ideas are liberal, the country gets more liberal as time goes on. On the way in tonight, I was listening to a little bit of Michael Savage. Don't ask me why. I guess because I had to turn off from Mark Levin. Both of them were ranting and raving like a couple of lunatics and not making a lot of sense, frankly. But their view of the world is America's going down the tubes and you people aren't doing anything to stop it. Don't you realize we're facing everything from, I mean, it's the equivalent of godless communism and reefer madness and, you know, gay contamination of our teachers or whatever it is. But it turns out these doomsayers are wrong. America, it was going to be just fine. And why they don't have faith in America and optimism like their hero, the Gipper, I don't know. But all of this is actually a sign of development, and so I'm not too concerned about America. We're going to be just fine. Let me move on to a couple more final issues in the world of international politics. The first is that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in Jerusalem over the weekend. Bush has just been there. And she urged Israeli officials to halt settlement expansion in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Of course, they didn't actually agree to her demands, but they just recently announced the building of a whole bunch of additional settlements. Now, under the roadmap to peace that President Bush put forward in 2003, or that Israel agreed to in 2003, they said they would stop all settlement activity. Right? But they are making the claim that some of these areas they've started are not new settlements because they're just adding to existing settlements. And, of course, they've already, as far as they're concerned, annexed East Jerusalem so they can build in the Jerusalem area. And any areas that are going to end up under their control under a new agreement, they feel they can build there too. Well, what's interesting was the Bush administration and conservatives and Republicans generally criticized Bill Clinton for his failed peace efforts and for being too close to Yasser Arafat. So when Bush came in, he said, you know, I know most times the new president continues the policies of his predecessor, if only for continuity for a while until you figure out what you're going to do. Bush seemed to be of the attitude that we're going to do something different. We're not going to do it the way the Democrats do it, the way Clinton did it, the way the old hands in Washington do it. So he came in, and because we were working a certain way in North Korea, they said, we're going to do the opposite. We're not going to talk to him. Because we were trying to work out an agreement with because we were trying to work out an agreement on the Middle East under Clinton, Bush said, no, I can't work with Arafat. And he was right, he couldn't. But he disengaged for almost 6 years, despite the roadmap for peace, which was never had much of a chance. And now he gets back in the Middle East the last couple of, the last 6 months, 9 months, and he's decided that peace is at hand. This is the year. Before he leaves office, we'll have a deal. Why? Not because parties are moving in that direction, not because he's nurtured the negotiations, but because he's leaving office, so the only logical time to do it is before he leaves. That's not the way the Middle East works, Mr. President. You don't have a snowball's chance in Phoenix of getting a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians and the rest of the Middle East before you leave office. It just can't be done. First of all, you're a lame duck and nobody's taking you seriously. Secondly, you've shown yourself to be partisan towards Israel. Bush gave away the store a couple of years ago when he said that, of course, we can't expect him to return to the original lines. He bought off on Ariel Sharon's logic. And so now when Condoleezza Rice comes in and says, stop the settlements, the Bush administration, this administration has backed Israel more than any other administration in our history. And they've ignored the Palestinians' concerns more than any administration in history. So the idea that Israel would take seriously a threat from the U.S. or a warning that says, hey, you got to stop building settlements, they're not going to do that. So, on top of all that, though, the president is in Europe for a week, and he continues to push his same mantra, which is democracy, freedom, capitalism, prosperity, that's what it takes. And so let's transform all these third world countries into democracies and everything will be fine. Now, it's not quite that simplistic, but it's close. And here's why that's oversimplistic. There's no evidence that you can take a country that's a tribal country and give it democratic institutions. It just doesn't work that way. Societal development proceeds in a logical order, and you cannot leapfrog over stages. At least that's what the evidence suggests to date. So going back to the model for spiral dynamics, and we've talked about this before on this show, Iraq, Iran, these are, at their heart, tribal societies. It's why, when there are killings and rampages, they're so vicious. It's why they talk past each other and they still worry about massacres that happened 700 years ago. It's simply that third world countries, tribal countries, are not ready for the levers of democracy. It requires a stage that takes us two very sophisticated forms of organization, that is, organizing governments, organizing corporations, organizing people. And there's just no evidence that you can leapfrog over these various stages. And yet Bush is out there with his mantra. And, of course, if you think about it, he didn't pick up this mantra of we must spread democracy, and that's why we attacked him, until it was shown that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Then he needed another rationale, and that's the rationale he's been using ever since. And, of course, it's stirring rhetoric, and who's going to argue with democracy, mom, and apple pie? But the bottom line is that Bush found this rationale long, long after we went into Iraq and then discovered there were no WMD. Oops! His bad. The Andy Finn Show will be right back.
Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on The Andy Finn Show, and today is June 16th, 2008. And on this date, in 1858, Abraham Lincoln gave his House Divided speech. Basically, he was saying that the slavery issue had to be resolved. He was a Senate candidate at this point in 1858, and he declared that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And what's interesting is, of course, 1858, he hadn't even held a Senate seat yet. So here's a guy unfit to be president, according to today's standards. If Barack Obama, 2 years in the Senate, isn't enough, how is it was enough for Abraham Lincoln? Now, I'm not saying Obama's another Abraham Lincoln. He doesn't even have a beard. But they each will have 2 years in the Senate when they rise to the presidency. Interesting. Also, this was the date the second Madison Square Gardens opened. And guess the year that the second Madison Square Gardens opened? You'll never believe it. 1890. I think that's the arena that's there today. Well, the escalators must be new. No, Madison Square Garden's not a bad arena. First of all, it's the greatest place in the world to see a sporting event or a concert, and I have seen many sporting events there. The Big East Tournament, the Knicks, the St. John's, teams like that, and I have seen many concerts there. including some of the most raucous Rolling Stones, Who, Led Zeppelin, and Pink Floyd concerts I have ever seen. But Madison Square Garden, the one they built in 1890, had to be an earlier version of it. And by the way, did you know that Madison Square Gardens is round? And that's because it's found at Madison Square, not because the place itself is square or was ever intended to be square. And finally, in the year 1978, President Jimmy Carter and Panamanian leader Omar Torrijos ratified the Panama Canal Treaties. It must be they signed it. You don't ratify it. The president doesn't ratify. Congress ratifies the Panama Canal Treaty. And as long as we're talking about this, it's worth mentioning this. That was something else that separated the left from the right. When Ronald Reagan was running for president, and this would have been right after Carter signed the Panama Canal Treaty, he was blustering. Actually, it was before he was running for president, when he was a radio talk show host. He was railing against this deal to give back the Panama Canal in 1999. I think that's when we gave it back. Maybe it was a few years before then. And what he said in summary was, we built it, we paid for it, and they can't have it. That was his attitude about the Panama Canal. Well, what he failed to realize was that the era of colonialism was over. And it's true we built it, but we also overthrew the previous government there and essentially pinched the Isthmus of Panama and then built the canal. We installed the government we wanted. Then we got them to sign a lease, a 100-year lease roughly, till 1999 for us to own the Panama Canal and run it. It was about time we gave it back to the people of Panama. And there were all kinds of predictions that, oh, without U.S. control, they'll raise rates beyond what people can afford. They'll close it down. Somebody will bomb it. There won't be security, all that stuff. Guess what? All those predictions that Ronald Reagan made and the conservatives and Republicans made in the late 70s, it's 30 years later. None of them have come true. They were wrong about this. And it goes back again to societal development and general levels of development. When you're in a blue state of mind and you're mature and you reflect on your behavior and you understand interdependence, you realize that just because you built the canal and paid for it 100 years ago, that's not canceled out. That does not cancel out the fact that we swiped it and we used the raw exercise of power to get it. That's not the way the U.S. says it operates in the world, so we had to stop operating that way. Jimmy Carter saw the light, and the timing was right. Reagan claimed he wouldn't stand for such a thing. He was elected president 2 years later. Did he do anything about the Panama Canal? I think you know the answer to that. The answer is no. He let the treaty go forward because somebody took him aside and explained it to him and said, oh, Mr. President, it's time we grew up. And he said, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. But it was time that we grew up. Let us move on now to a couple of things. I want to say a few words about Tim Russert, and I don't know if we'll even get to the campaign this week. There isn't that much happening on the campaign anyway. But Tim Russert died last Friday at the age of 58. In fact, he's my age. He was born in 1950. He's a few months older than me. And he really left a void, first of all, at NBC, and secondly, in journalism. I was actually surprised at the outpouring of affection and the accolades for him. I mean, I've always liked him, and I thought he was a heck of a guy. And I like his smile and the way he laughs, and he's fair to everybody and in a good mood and treats everybody well, apparently privately. But I was just a little surprised, A, at how much coverage there was, and it wasn't just MSNBC covering it all afternoon and into the evening on Friday, but even Fox and CNN devoted hours of coverage to the death of Tim Russert. And, of course, they didn't have any details about the death. It was sudden. It was a heart attack, apparently, and he was taken to the hospital. So what they really have focused on is his legacy and what he meant to the industry. And what he meant was, to most people, he was fair. Even on Fox News, the people that rail against the mainstream media, and I just love this. I'm watching Fox News this morning, I guess it was. Don't ask me why. That morning show they have with, is it Steve Doocy? Steve Doocy, who's not, my problem is I think that a lot of the Fox hosts aren't all that bright. But he starts railing about the mainstream media, and I don't even remember the issue. But basically he was saying, do you think the mainstream media report on this? Oh, if something had happened to Obama, and they're saying if it had happened to McCain, they'd be all over it. No, it was a minor thing. They wouldn't be, but that's his bias and point of view. But here he is on Fox News claiming that the mainstream media isn't doing this as though he's not part of the mainstream media. That's what I find hilarious about it. Anyway, even Fox News analysts who rail against the liberal media and all this stuff, even they had to admit that Tim Russert was fair, tough questioner, but fair and relatively balanced. Of course, that's Fox News' slogan, so they wouldn't use it to apply to an NBC guy. But boy, were they kind to him. What I thought was interesting is by this morning, Fox News had moved on to who do you think will replace him? And of course, they get two conservative radio talk show hosts on to discuss who is likely to replace Tim Russert. And basically, they're saying they don't have anybody. David Gregory could probably fill the bill because he's a reporter and he's relatively fair, but he's no Tim Russert. And it certainly can't be somebody like Chris Matthews, he argued. I don't know that this would be Matthews' kind of gig anyway. I guess it would be. I don't know if he would take it. I'm sorry, he would take it. I don't know if they'd give it to him. But what I thought was interesting about what they said was they expressed total disgust for Matthews and basically said that, you know, he said recently something about he gets a tickle up his leg when he sees Barack Obama speaking. And they made fun of that as though that made him liberal. Well, if you read the liberals about this, they dislike Matthews because he's so obviously biased towards conservatives and Republicans, and that he has a man crush on George Bush, and they go through all this stuff. But Matthews, in fact, has made some very strange statements about a lot of Republicans and conservatives. He has tremendous respect for a lot of them. He talks about, and he certainly runs down Hillary Clinton a lot more than he runs down George W. Bush or Dick Cheney, although he's pretty tough with Cheney, admittedly. And he tells it like it is on the war and a few other things occasionally, but not always. So it's just an interesting phenomenon, the way the far right and far left look at these things. But beyond that, we haven't even had the funeral of Tim Russert yet, and people are talking about, on Fox News, they're talking about, now who do you think will replace him? And they're turning it into a political thing. So the other thing about Tim Russert that's interesting was that he had two best-selling books, and he didn't choose to publish political books or analysis books. What he published was a book about his father called Big Russ, I think is the title of it. And in it, he talks about how everything he has he got from his father. Now, his father's still alive and is still with us. I haven't heard from Big Russ. I assume he'll stay private about this. But then he wrote a best-selling book. A lot of people wrote him letters about the book he wrote about his father, and they wrote letters about their relationship with their dad and how it went and how much his book meant to him. And so he published a second book about fatherhood and the relationship between fathers and sons in particular, and it all stemmed from that first book and the relationship he had with his dad. So I think Russert's contribution, one of the reasons he's beloved is that he goes beyond politics and beyond being fair and funny and really dealt with issues that people cared about. But enough about that. I'll just say, rest in peace, Tim Russert. And that brings us to the close of another edition of The Andy Finn Show. We'll be back next week on the 23rd of June. Until then, you can read my blogs, my writings, and listen to previous shows and pick up podcasts or sign up for podcasts at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us, as in the United States. Until next week, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.